Welcome to the Aviator Zone Podcast. Aviator Zone Podcast. With your host, Captain Felipe Santiago. Flying stories, career advice, and a lot of hangar talk. Let's talk aviation.
Hi, and welcome back to the Aviator Zone Podcast. Today we have Colonel Dennis Daly, who is a retired Air Force F-16 instructor pilot with over 1,000 sorties and combat sorties, also retired Delta pilot, flying the 777 all over the world. Colonel, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So today I want to kind of give an overview of his career. How did you got started into flying? So please tell me, what got you into aviation? How did it all start and how did it all end? Tell me about it.
Well, Felipe, first of all, I really appreciate being able to be here. You know, I'm getting older now, so it's nice to pass on stories. It's nice to have a podcast where people may listen to them or not, but it's nice to be able to tell stories at least. But, you know, I grew up on a farm in Illinois. So my parents were farmers, and we didn't have a lot of money. But there was a little grass airstrip pretty close to where we lived. And my father had friends that were farmers. One of them had an airplane. And so, you know.
What airplane was it?
A 150.
Okay.
An old 150. And I don't even know if he had a license or not anymore, you know, but it was a grass strip. There's nobody out there. It was pretty unregulated. But I used to watch Sky King, you know, and I'd watch, you know, back in the day. And by the way, I'm older than you may think. So, but, you know, I had a real interest in flying. My dad knew that. We didn't have a lot of money, but he's very supportive. So, you know, that gets back into parents supporting what their kids have interest in, of course.
Super important.
But super important. And so he got me rides with Jerry. And Jerry McDermott was this guy. We'd fly around at 500 feet. We'd go look at these cows and fly around and
so
stuff.
So he used a 150 for inspection. Obviously, no crop dusting in a 150.
Nah,
so
he'd go look at these fields. He'd go look at the cows. He'd fly around, look at buildings. He'd look at anything, you know, just to go flying. And he'd take me with him. And then my dad got me some lessons with a guy named Jim Baird. And Jim Baird was an ex-World War II Air Force pilot that was an instructor. And that was in a 172. And he got me a few lessons. And I sold it on my 16th birthday.
Nice.
So on my 16th birthday, my dad took me down to Canton, Illinois, and I got my driver's license at 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, and then we went out, and my instructor then was Ed Reinholz, and Ed took me out for a couple touch-and-go warm-ups, and he says, I think you're on your own now.
Off you go.
He and my dad stood over in the grass while I did some touch-and-goes, and so it was a pretty big day.
So 16 years old, you had your license, and then you had your you went solo, or you got your license.
I got my driver's license, and I soloed
like
2 hours later.
2 hours later.
And then, so then, you know, my parents, my mom and dad were both really instrumental in this. And I had another instructor, and her name was Ethel Scheffler. And Ethel was a World War II WAF who delivered airplanes all over the United States. She delivered fighters, she delivered bombers, she flew everything.
Wow.
And so she had all this experience on stuff, and she was just a great instructor. You know, she had all the qualities that would make you calm and help you and encourage you and stuff. But her and my dad came up with this idea that the only way I'm really going to get some experience is to take a long cross country. And I don't have I've got about 35 hours. And so I'm 17 years old. I've got 35 hours and a 150.
What was the requirement back then? Was it 40 hours or was it less?
No, it was hardly anything. You know, you'd go take the test.
Go take the test.
I didn't have my private yet. I just soloed.
Right.
So I'm still waiting to get my private, but they go, the only way you're going to get confidence, the only way you're going to learn and learn about how to get ready for the written test and all this other stuff is to go do this. So we had friends in Marathon in the Keys. And now we're up here in the middle of Illinois, and it's a long flight in the summer with the haze and the thunderstorms and everything else. But we took the charts and we did the planning and we draw the lines.
Tape them together.
Drew the lines. So I had a grocery bag full of charts. And little flight plans on them, you know, and everything. And it was all VFR. And back then in the 150, we had one radio and we had one VOR, and that was it.
Wow.
And so there was no GPS.
A lot of pilot vision, dead reckoning.
Oh, yeah. No, just go fly. So Ethel and my dad, you know, kind of got this all set up. My mom was having a heart attack over it, you can imagine. And I took off and I flew the first leg down someplace in Kentucky, and the VOR didn't work. So, you know, this is a long trip, and the VOR already doesn't work. And so I landed, and I called Ethel, and I said, Ethel, the VOR doesn't work.
So they sent you by yourself?
Yeah, solo. Solo trip, 17 years old.
I thought they were going to put you
hours with
an instructor.
No, no, this is like, you're going to learn how to fly, or you're not going to make it.
Or you either come back or you don't come back.
Yeah,
one of the two.
We're just going to throw you out here and go. And And so I called her and I said, the VOR doesn't work. And she goes, well, you still got your maps, right? And I go, yeah. And she goes, well, just get going. You'll be fine. And so it was map reading from Kentucky all the way through probably like five control zones I didn't know was there, all the way down through to Marathon in the Keys.
Had you ever talked on the radio before?
Oh, yeah, a little bit, but
you know. Were you flying out of controlled airport, or was it uncontrolled?
Like? Some of it was controlled. Galesburg was controlled field, so I talked to towers.
So you had a little bit of experience with the
radio. Not much. There's another story about that. It goes badly, too. But so, you know, it's like I trundle along, and it's like map reading, and you're like looking at railroad tracks and water towers and all the stuff, interstates and all the things you do.
I heard they used to put the name of the cities on these.
On the water towers.
On the water towers, so the pilots knew where they were.
You could almost see it, too, if you're low enough. But you know, so, you know, just flying the course is just having faith in the system, you know, and flying the track and, you know, doing timing and, you know, looking at your watch and going, okay, well, that's about right. And then there'll be a town loom out of the haze, and there it is, and that's probably the right place. And so, you know, I did this for like 3 days.
Wow.
And a couple legs a day. And once in one little airport, I slept on the couch because there's no taxis back then or Uber or anything.
How did you call back to your instructor and like position reports and all that stuff?
Because
there was no flight aware to look and see, he's pointing in the right direction.
Payphone, you used to have credit cards back then for payphones. And so I'd go to the payphone, I'd call them, let them know I'm here. And that was it. That's all I cared about. And I got to one place, and there was the airport's out in the country, and the guy was really nice. The FBO was really nice. He says, look, you can sleep on the couch there tonight. And there's a shower in the hangar. You can use that shower. And so it was, you know, a great night's sleep. And he brought me an egg sandwich next morning. And then off we go again. But, you know, and then the people I stayed with in Marathon, he was a World War II pilot, but he was a Korean War F-86 pilot. And he'd flown the F-86 a lot. And so he was, like, very inspirational. And he sat down and talked to me for a day or two. You know, we did a little fishing. And he talked to me, and he says, look, you know, you did really good getting here. Just keep it up. You know, a little pep talk. You know, I kind of needed a pep talk to get back in the airplane, you know. And so I go, okay, good. And so I did the same thing going home. You know, pulled out some more maps, you know, followed the roads, bought fuel. And tremendous turning point in my flying career. Because I doubled my flying time almost in that trip.
Right.
But I had so much awareness now.
Well, I mean, the lessons that you learn on that trip, you know.
Insane. But the confidence building I got day in and day out over each sortie, each trip, was just really, really big.
That was a real cross country, right? You're really crossing the country.
And I learned so much about it. I learned so much about just, you know, you as you get more comfortable, you see more. And this is like anything else we do flying, right? Mm-hmm. The more comfortable you get in the airplane, the more you see. And so one of the things that came out of that then I became a CFI when I was in college. I went to college at Southern Illinois University. And so I was in the aviation program there. I got my A&P mechanics rating, power plant mechanic rating. And then I finished up the rest of my ratings there. And I was under an Air Force contract for to be a pilot.
So you finished, so the story, you got your pilot's license, assuming after you came back from that trip. And that was just a private pilot?
Yeah, knocked out the private pilot.
Off to college,
got an Air Force scholarship. But the big thing is I got my CFI later on in school, and I taught, you know, as a CFI, like many of your guys are doing here.
Right.
And I really admire the CFI role. I really, really think it's a great, fundamental, important thing that everybody has to do at some point in their life. They have to teach. They have to learn how to teach.
Right.
And learn how to see if people are learning. But one of the things I did at the school was a 141 school. And, you know, I'd learned so much on this stupid cross country that I did years ago that, you know, I asked the director of the program, I said, look, can I take my student and go out to this airfield and land and get a Coke and then come back? Can we have like a 3-hour block? And he goes, sure. He says, I like it. So he let me do that. So I started doing that with my students. And my students started doing so much better than all the other students. They progress so much faster. Because we'd go out and we'd do some air work on the way out, but the student had to find the airfield. He had to talk on the radio, he had to set the pattern up, he had to worry about the winds, he had to do all the stuff. And then we'd go to the Coke machine there after we land, we'd get a Coke, and we'd talk about it.
Debrief.
And then he'd have to do it all over again. Take off, do the flows, go do it again. Well, that second trip, you learned so much more on that second leg. And so my students progressed quite quickly, and so they started doing that then. They developed more out bases and started doing more short leg cross country type work.
That's basically what we do for a living, right? We go from point A to point B.
Yeah.
And that whole entry and setting that up and visualizing it in your brain. I was very lucky when I was growing up, I was flying a lot with older guys that had their airplanes. I mean, back when we used to really fly a lot for the $200 hamburger or the $100 hamburger. And they would all come into the flight school and be like, hey, I'm going to go grab some lunch. You want to come along? Of course. So I was flying a lot of different airplanes and also getting that experience of going to a lot of different airports.
Exactly.
Different entries, different patterns, different towers. You know, yeah, we all speak the same language, but that exposure, and you come back and you got weather on the way back and how to navigate around and make those decisions. You learn significantly more when you do cross country.
Yeah. So I think that was a big deal teaching. And then the other thing that I thought was really fundamental about teaching, and you know, you guys have a tremendous CFI business here, and Juan and I have talked a lot about your students and stuff, but having a really, really good understanding of the systems in the airplane, no matter what type of airplane it is. If it's a primary airplane and you're starting out and it's a 152 or whatever you're flying, Diamond or whatever it would be, but understanding simple things like the electrical system a little bit. You know, so if I lose an alternator, if I have the alternator light come on, oh, look, maybe I can turn the pitot heat off and look at my battery and go, oh, okay, I'm fine. I got enough battery power to talk on the radios and land.
Yeah.
So that simple knowledge,
system knowledge
to start with.
Well, it takes a lot of the stress of, oh my God, you know, okay, is this a really big deal or is this not a big deal, right?
Yeah.
Immediately, system knowledge allows you to be like, not a big deal.
How do I cope?
Yeah, and you can just continue to an airport, I'll be fine, you know?
Yeah.
It makes a huge difference. So talk to me about college. You became a CFI, and then after college, the Air Force had your name written down, and it was...
Well, yeah, I had a four-year scholarship.
What made you choose the Air Force? What?
We didn't have enough money to go to college.
Okay.
So my parents had enough money to probably get me through the first year. We had applied for the scholarship, and back then, you know, it's like it was a very simple process. It wasn't like it is now. You filled out two pieces of paper and mailed it off, and so I got put on the wait list in September of that year as I started college for a four-year scholarship. And my mom wrote a letter to our congressman. And this is where I think that everybody needs to be aware of how much your congressman can help you sometimes. Because she wrote just a nice letter and said, my son's doing this, and he's on the wait list right now with the Air Force. And I just wanted to see if you could reach out and see how he's going to do, you know. And
he listened.
Yeah. And so in October, they offered me a scholarship.
Wow.
And so I took that, of course. And that gave me 4 years of school. And I did my aeronautical science degree, did a business degree after that. And then later on, then I finished my MBA and Master's of Aeronautical Science both.
Wow.
So, but, you know, long story short, I was able to get my ratings, get my ANP, get some experience. And my roommate at the time was a pilot. And so he and I bought a Cherokee 140. And we bought it from our power plant instructor because he owned it and it was run out. The motor was run out. But he says, look, if you guys buy this from me, and he liked us, you know, he goes, if you buy this from me, I'll help you rebuild the engine. That'll be your practical for your sign-off.
Perfect.
And we got all our parts at discount through the aeronautical school. You know, and so so we rebuild this airplane, you know, and rebuild the engine and stuff. It's a pretty ratty-looking airplane. But we didn't pay much for it, of course. But we take it out, you know, we push it out when it's done. And we start it, and like half the school was watching.
Is it going to blow up or is it going to start? One of the two.
Half the school was watching to see, because we got to break it in. Let's just see if it starts first, you know. And it ran, and we'd replace the accessories and stuff. And so like it was pretty cool. And so we bought a transponder, overhauled the engine, and flew it for like 600 hours.
Wow.
And so, you know, through college then, he and I would fly people back and forth to Chicago and just split gas and stuff.
Back when AV gas was...
Jack gas was cheap. And, you know, we'd split gas with kids, and you know, to get them home to see their parents and, you know. But overall, it allowed me to build a lot of just interesting time. Yeah. So...
And then the Air Force. So you finished your school, and then you went into the Air Force. Did you know that you were going to be flying? Like, how does that...
Yeah, it was still a little tight back then, but I knew I had a flying position. So that was a big deal. And, you know, I had some trepidation about it because all my friends were going to United at the time. And I was in the Alpha Eta Rho fraternity. And so they were very instrumental in getting kids into United. And but, you know, I was destined to go in the Air Force. I go, okay, fine, smartly go in the Air Force. And I loved every minute of it. So I get in there, and you're around some really, really inspirational people. The flight program's very, very good. I mean, head and shoulders above anything I'd really done previous to that in structure and measurement and professionalism and everything you could even think about. And then we're flying the T-37, T-38s and stuff like that, so that's always fun. But yeah, I went to flight school and got done with that. Went to electronic warfare school, which is kind of a different animal. But that enabled me to do some other things then as I moved on in my Air Force career. So, you know, long story short, you know, I had a very strong start in aviation. You know, I had good fundamentals starting with my dad, really, and my instructor kicking me out the door to go fly across country. And then I had a really strong background from the university at Southern Illinois University.
So you knew, so it's a little different now, no? For somebody that wants to be a pilot in the Air Force, they don't really know that they're going to be in a flying position until pretty much at the end of that contract.
I think they do. I think the Air Force is still signing people up to be a pilot. They'll still put them on a scholarship. University of Miami is one of the great resources right here. But I think they'll tell them you're going to be this or this. It's a contract. And so at the end of it, you still get to go to flight school if your grades are good and you graduate and your physical abilities are still okay.
So you have to meet those standards and then they put you into flight school.
And the standards aren't hard. You know, it's a great deal. For somebody who wants to go fly, flying military aircraft is fun because you're going to fly all over the world. You're going to fly different things. You're going to do different things. You're going to be around really cool people.
Where did you go to school for the military? So when you went to your initial, that's T-37, T-38?
Yeah.
What was that school?
Columbus.
Columbus.
I went to Columbus, Mississippi.
So how was that going already? You know, you had a couple thousand hours already, right? The majority of the students going in there.
No, I didn't have that much. I had about 800 hours, give or take.
800 hours. Still pretty significant amount of hours for somebody compared to the majority of the students are coming with nothing.
Yeah, the quickest way to have a problem.
It's have flight hours.
It's have flight hours. It's to think you know something when you don't. And they want you to do it their way and their cadence and their with their checklist. And there's no saying, well, and probably this applies everywhere. No matter what you've done in the past, if you're sitting with an instructor and you're working together and you say, well, over here we used to do it like this.
You're on the wrong foot.
Yeah, it's the wrong. So anytime you start to say that phrase, it's just my two cents, stop it.
Yeah, you know? even on an airline training, like you hear, the number one thing instructors complain about is, oh, but I used to do it this way in my other airline. Well, you're not at your other airline anymore.
Yeah, that's not what we want. So that was a kiss of death. So, but it also, though, gave me great situational awareness at different times. So, you know, I had a really high score for my pilot training class. And you know, long story short, it was a great time.
You finish your T-38 school and then from there, you get assigned the aircraft that you're going to be flying for the Air Force, or they are assigned that already before?
They assigned that. I went to Germany and flew the F-4, and I was a backseater in the F-4. So I was assigned to the backseat, flew there for 2.5 years, came back here to Homestead, and then never left Homestead. So I was on active duty all the way through 1986. And then went to the reserve unit there. And then we transitioned in the reserve unit to F-16s. I was lucky enough to get an F-16 transition as well.
So you go through training all over again now to fly this airplane.
Yeah.
Going from the F-4 to the 16, how was that transition?
Great leap. Great quantum leap. You know, really nice time. And the F-4 was just a really cool airplane. You know, it weighs 60,000 pounds, and it's got two huge, massive engines that produce a lot of thrust. It makes a lot of noise, and it burns a lot of fuel. And it goes really fast. But that's about it, you know. And it did its thing in the in the time it was called on to do that. So, you know, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it was a great airplane for the military. And then the F-16 is a quantum leap again. It's a generational change in fighters.
Right.
So just like the F-22 is a quantum leap above the F-16, it was a big deal, and it's a fun airplane to fly. I can promise you that.
I mean, you have your resume over a thousand sorties.
Yeah.
Is that because of instructing? I mean, that's pretty high for an average Air Force pilot.
It's over the F-16 sorties were over 12 years.
Okay.
You know, and we would fly, we would try to fly 8 to 12 sorties a month to stay proficient. And, you know, some of them were instructional sorties where you're checking somebody out, and some of them are just training sorties where you're on the wing flying as well. So you had to be a good wingman as well as be an instructor. But I was also full-time in the reserve unit at Homestead. So I was in the 93rd Fighter Squadron there, the Makos. And I went through the whole process there to become an instructor. But only at certain times were you really teaching. Most of the time you're learning too.
Right.
Because you're flying with some of the most professional guys you've ever seen, some of the most experienced guys you've ever met. And a lot of them are fighter weapons school graduates, very, very experienced, and it's just a great place to learn. So, you know, I spent probably 80% of my time
learning.
You know, and then because I was full-time in the squadron, I needed to keep a instructor rating to be fully qualified there, so that worked out well too. But overall, it's like the F-16 is just a fabulous airplane.
What was the, I mean, I can imagine your first time soloing, right? Nobody forgets their first time soloing, but how about when you solo one of these jets? Like, how was the first time flying by yourself in that airplane?
It was pretty neat. You're just hoping none of the lights come on because you really don't understand how the flight control system works or anything else, really. You know, and there's all kinds of you know, little drills you do ahead of time, little system checks you do before you fly. But you're just hoping, you know, that none of the lights come on, everything goes just kind of normal, you know. And so it did. I was out in Tucson for that training. And it worked out fine. You know, I got to solo, and we all went out and had a party that night afterwards and stuff. But it's pretty cool.
Talking about systems knowledge with these airplanes, right, because obviously there's a secret part, and you guys have clearance as well, but do they really teach you everything about that airplane, or there's some stuff in that airplane that not even the pilots really know about because of...
They teach you everything. I mean, you know, you fundamentally learn it as fast as you can learn it. It takes years to really understand...
How the whole system works. So. I also heard they take a while, too, to power up. So it's not like something you can just go jump in and power it on.
Well, it kind of works both ways. You know, we can set the airplane up for a scramble and go out and be gone in 3 minutes, you know, which is pretty cool. You know, you know, throw the jet fuel starter on the battery and throw the throttle up and off you go. Or most of the time we would sit and we would align all the systems and check all the systems, go through a whole series of checks and everything.
Well, aligning, can you define a little bit?
Well, and you know, we have inertial navigation systems.
So you have to wait for the IRSs to align.
We have to wait for the IRSs to come up. You have to wait for, you know, the GPS tie-in now to make sure everything's good.
So it just took a while. So you'd be able to fight, but you wouldn't have like a GPS position or...
Well, you know, again, it's like a rough... there's kind of two ways. We can go now if we want to, but we set the airplane up with a rough alignment. It's okay. Like a quick start alignment.
Right, got it.
So you can just jump in, turn the knobs on and go. But that takes prior setup. Or you can, you know, take 12, 15 minutes and spool everything up, check all the weapons, you know, check everything you're supposed to check.
Yeah, the reason I ask, I was just watching this really good documentary of the two fighter pilots that came up, the first ones to come up when the 9/11 attack, and they were absolutely not ready for this at all. They were not even ready aircraft. They didn't have any weapons or anything. And they're talking about the same thing. It's like, we're sitting there like, okay, well,
what are we going to do now?
There's nothing to really have on board, so let's go.
Yeah.
But I also heard that the newer airplanes take even longer to, like the 35, they take a little bit longer because they got more technology and all that stuff to get them there.
I have no idea. Yeah. I'm an old man. It's a young man's game, and I don't know. But, you know, I think the big takeaway, though, from the F-16 or military flying is that, you know, you really have to master the systems. So you really have to learn the airplane, and this goes for any airplanes, the Airbus, whatever you're flying. You know, you're a captain. It's up to you. You're responsible.
Right.
So learning the systems really well so you can make a good decision.
Yeah, and you see that a lot. I think the Airbus kind of doesn't teach much of that. And the new airplanes that we have nowadays don't really teach much of, okay, learn your systems.
Yeah.
If it's in the green, you're good. And if it doesn't ding, you're good. And a lot of pilots rely on that. But having that knowledge background really makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I think, you know, Sully was flying the Airbus. You know, when he ditched the airplane in the Hutchins, which is a pretty cool movie, pretty cool experience for him, and is a lifesaver for a lot of people. But I think the big takeaway, Schmidt, is that, you know, he kind of deviated back to his personal knowledge of the airplane, did a few things that allowed him to save the airplane.
Yeah, made it a bit glider.
So, yeah, it's like, so, you know, I think that no matter if you're starting out or if you're very experienced, whatever airplane it is you fly, you have to learn the flows, you have to learn the checklist, you have to read the emergency procedures and really understand them. And that teaches you the systems.
Yeah.
So
it definitely makes you a better pilot. You have combat missions too in your resume. Can you talk about those? Like, is there something you can?
You know, not a lot, one or two, but we did Operation Northern Watch and Southern Watch from Homestead quite a bit, and so I flew with Tom Carr, who's now passed away, but he and I flew a mission together. That was pretty fun. You know, it was a lot of fun. That morning, a good story, you know, because you kind of like go, well, we're all reservists. And that means that we have civilian jobs, like airline jobs, and then we fly, you know, military
just for
missions.
Fun.
And you can end up over in Kuwait or in Turkey or someplace getting ready to fly over Iraq, and your whole life can change.
No time.
In no time. And so a good story about that is that we were sitting down for breakfast like 3:30 in the morning, and I was sitting with Keith Beam, and Keith's just a great guy, probably one of the greatest fighter pilots in the world. And one of the younger guys comes over and sits down across from us, and we've got like these big massive mounts of food, you know, potatoes and the whole thing. And he's got a bowl of cereal. And he looks up at us, got a big grin on his face, and says, "Wow, you guys are really chow hounds this morning." And Keith's got a really dry delivery, and he just looks up at him and goes, "Well, you never know when you're gonna eat again." And that kind of puts it all in perspective, you know. You're sitting here with your Delta Airlines ID and $100 and a gold American Express card in your pocket.
You can eat anywhere you want.
Just hoping I can get anywhere on the ground I need to, but that's not really how it's gonna work. But no, it's like then you go do the stuff you're trained for, and it was fun. You know, it was a neat experience.
Can you talk a little bit about the mission, like what you guys did, or
I don't even remember.
Wow.
I don't even remember that much of it now. So, but you know, it was just fun, and it all worked out fine. And the 93rd deployed a lot of different times. They're still deploying to combat theaters. So you know, it's a great organization, great reserve unit.
I'll go back because you were also the squadron commander for Homestead Air Reserve Base, correct?
I was the mission support group commander, which is essentially the person in charge of all the facilities there. So I owned the runway, all the facilities, 158 buildings, 2,000 people, a $50 million budget, all the things that made the base run. It's like being the mayor of a small city. So then the operations guys, there was a colonel in charge of the operations side, and then there was a colonel in charge of maintenance. And they ran their own organizations, and the three of us then worked together to kind of run the base. And then we worked for a wing commander.
Gotcha.
And he was a colonel or general that kind of made us all work and play well together.
So that, I'm sure that taught you a lot, you know, managing that much of a budget and keeping all these buildings going. And
you know, it gave me institutional experience. And part of the things that helped me be a success at doing this, because I did it for 6 years, and in 6 years you can figure out if you're doing okay or not. Was that I had a really, really strong super deputy who was a major, and he was just a rock star. And then I had an executive assistant that was a rock star, and so I had this team of people that helped.
Great team.
Yeah, great team. So as I came out of the military and stuff and started doing things in the civilian world, you know, I realized that I still need a team. You know, I still need to assimilate people that can help me with the things that I want to do in life next. So you know, that was a good lesson learned from there, is that the stronger the team is around you, the better off you're going to do. So
absolutely.
Just like here at Aviator Zone, you know, you guys have a phenomenal team.
Yeah, if I couldn't do my job without my team, you know,
when I started. I wouldn't be sitting here without the guys here and without, you know, the organization that you guys
absolutely.
Have.
Absolutely.
So the team thing is a huge deal. No matter what aspect it is in life, you don't have to be on SEAL Team 6 to know about a team. You know, so it could be anything. But, you know, if you're in private business, you know, having a really strong marketing guy, having a really strong connections for web design or, you know, or electronic sales or whatever, internet sales, you know, whatever it is, your team is your go-to people.
We have a saying in Spanish, tell me who you're with and I'll tell you who you are.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, it applies to that team. If your team is a strong, solid team, then, you know, it's going to make me look very successful because they're going to do all their job and it's going to allow me to be able to do my other parts of my job.
Yeah, very
right?
much
I couldn't
so.
Be... I guess when we first started Aviator Zone, I was everything, right? But, you know, as we get bigger and bigger and bigger, it's a team. Like, I can't do it, you know, I can't do it by myself. So
no, you can,
it makes
you,
sense.
You can never watch 150 grade books.
No,
you know, can't. You can never oversee.
Teach
you know,
150 students.
You know, 20 people flying at a time out in the U.S.
Of course.
And but you guys' school is very impressive. You guys have
Thank
a tremendous
you.
School.
Yeah, we work hard. 24 hours a day. It's kind of like a little base.
Yeah.
So... At the same time that you were in the military, so you did active duty for some point.
I did 10 years of active duty, went in the reserve unit, and stayed at Homestead my entire career almost the whole time.
So then at that point when you finish your active duty time, you said, okay, now I'm going to go try the airlines?
Well, it's kind of like timing. You know, I've got all this... You know, this active duty time and so on, so I do want to stay associated with the military as best I can, but I'm coming up on... 40 years old. Delta Airlines is hiring, American's hiring. You know, I've got the qualifications, and I go, you know, back then the retirement age was 60. So I said, I can work for 20 years. I can get 20 years in here with
another
the airline.
Another retirement with the airlines.
So I go, I might as well try it. So I applied to Delta and American only. And Delta called me. I got an interview. A lot of friends in the squadron, a lot of different people helped me get ready for the interview, learn how to say the right things and do the right things, you know, act the right way. But tremendous company. You know, I was so happy that I went there. And And, you know, Delta's still just a great, great place to work.
You were based in Atlanta?
I was based in Atlanta. I commuted from Miami the whole time.
So how many, so 20 years, you commuted 20 years, you went to?
So I did 25 years.
25.
But, you know, commuting was easy because we could reserve the jump seat. So I could call ahead. I could make sure I had a flight up to Atlanta when I needed it. I flew domestically on the 737. You know, originally I was on the 727 as a flight engineer, so I got some systems knowledge. And
how was the 727? Everybody that flies that airplane just,
you know, the flight engineer type rating, the oral, was 5 hours long. and that was normal, 4 to 5 hours. That was normal. Wow. For a new engineer, you're on probation. Your whole career is ahead of you on how well you do on this ride.
Engineer.
If you don't pass, you're done. And it was like everything. I mean, there's three engines, there's three electrical systems, there's three hydraulic systems, there's all the different things.
And there was no system logic back then.
And it was a mess.
You were the system logic.
Yeah, the airplane was a mess, and you're the plumber. You're the guy that had to fix everything and put everything together. And they would go, well, what if this light comes on? Oh, you know. So it was the hardest thing that I'd really done to date. Was the 727 flight
harder than the jets and the Air Force?
All of it.
Wow.
It was hard, and so we got past that. So skin of my teeth, I survived that. But then I went on and I flew the 737 200, first officer and captain, and I flew the 737 as a first officer. And what I was doing was I was protecting my seniority because I'm still flying in the reserves actively, and that's 10 to 12 days a month for sure. But then...
How does the airline work that schedule with you flying reserve and also...
We could bid trips pretty easily. Like, you know, it's just like Spirit. We could bid trips, pick and choose what we want, and then fit our reserve flying in. Or if I needed to have time off, I could do military drops. I could do up to so many military drops over a period of time.
So does the Air Force allow you to kind of set up your schedule when you can fly, like the days that you can come in? Or they give you, say, hey, you have to come in these days?
Sometimes.
Okay.
You know, and in all honesty, sometimes both companies would say, we need you here for training or we need you here for flying.
Right.
And so, yeah, it was a give and take, but it worked good. It was a great system. And it allowed me to continue. And your proficiency.
There's a lot of guys that do that.
A lot of guys. Mm-hmm. And it's a natural fit. And, you know, as an airline guy, you understand that, you know, you have aviator zone here. But you have, when you're not at the airline, you're not doing anything unless it's something productive and you want it to be. So being in the reserves was a very productive thing for me to do. It gave me a lot of security also, you know, being with the airlines and being junior in case I would get furloughed or something. So it was nice safety net. And it was thoroughly enjoyable because, you know, you'd see all kinds of people you know in operations up in Atlanta or JFK or wherever you're at, you know. And so, but I always protected my seniority so that I could pick and choose. I could be home for Christmas, be home for the holidays. I had young son playing sports, so I could be home to watch those games as much as possible. And so I kind of guarded my lifestyle. And I put money kind of second, guarded my lifestyle. And I did that also when I went to the 777. I spent my last 15 years on the 777. And first officer the whole time. So, you know, it's the best deal in the airlines. I mean, you're over here, and if there's a problem, you look over at the captain, you go, it's not my problem. But, you know, and most of the time
Captain, got to go. My commute's coming.
Yeah. Well, most of the time you're dealing in the 777, you're really not dealing with airplane problems. You're dealing with people problems. And so it was great to look over
the captain.
A lot
more people to deal with on that airplane, right?
Yeah.
More likely chance of somebody having an issue.
We flew ultra long haul, which is 12 hours or greater flights. So, you know, we'd come out of Atlanta or JFK, Minneapolis, wherever, but we would go to Tel Aviv, Johannesburg, South Africa, Beijing, Singapore.
How's the routing going from Atlanta? Like, did you just point it direct?
Atlanta, Johannesburg. Draw a straight line down the middle of the ocean.
Direct, enter, and just send it? Like, is there airways that go out there? Like,
some, but most of the time it's, there's a ton of airways that connect
and
everything.
It's all GPS navigation,
yes.
I'm assuming. There's no...
Yeah, no, it's super tight GPS. And it was all data linked and everything. It was all very sophisticated. It was all very well scripted.
All data linked, no HF, not even HF.
We had HF.
So you had HF, but
we had to have HF and data link, both functional.
But I'm assuming there's peers that you don't have not even HF coverage.
No? Oh, yeah. No, you always
you
had
do?
HF.
Oh, interesting.
And, and so we'd fly right down the middle of the Atlantic between, you know, Africa and Brazil. And to get an idea of how big this area is, you know, you'd look at it and go, Well, if you had a medical emergency come up at certain points, you were 4 or 5 hours
from the nearest
from airport. A divert base. So, you know, a lot of times if you had a medical emergency come up or something like that, the correct answer was, we're going to take you on to Johannesburg, you know, but we'd always go through the dance. And most of the things we dealt with, you know, abnormally were medical emergencies.
Wow.
So people would have all kinds of things happen to them when they've been in the airplane for a long time. And you know, the Joburg flight was 14 hours long.
Any, you know, what, diversion plans? Like, I'm assuming you have the dispatching on that has to be like...
Yeah, the dispatch is a science. And Delta were, the dispatchers there were just masterful. But yeah, it's a science. And you had different dispatch approved.
It's a two-engine airplane. So ETOPS. ETOPS,
yeah.
So 120 minutes from...
I think we were approved for 180.
180 minutes but, from an airport.
Yeah, and then there's all the different waivers they get and everything else. So, but...
I mean, there's what's out there.
Well, you got the Canary Islands. You've got I can't remember the name of the island. It's off the coast of Africa. Ascension Island. I think it's, no, it's not Ascension. I can't remember it. But
did you ever have to divert to any of these airports?
No.
Any mechanical issues like on?
You know, in the 777, we had very few. Most of them were self-induced. You know, it's stuff that you'd do that. You know, because you know you'd be looking at something or change something or not really understand what you're doing at the time. So most of the things that happened to us were either self-induced or really not an airplane problem. But most of the things that we actually dealt with on 777 were people management. You know, it was we didn't have, thank God, as many physical altercations as it seems like that trend has come up now. But we had more medical things, and it was just due to the nature of the long flight, dehydration. People buying like Ambien in India or Korea.
Ambien?
Ambien is like a sleeping drug, sleeping pill. Super strong when you buy it overseas.
And they basically would pass out in flight.
Yeah, because people wanted to say, oh, I just want to take something and sleep the whole way. Well, these things were super strong. So they'd take that. Then, you know, the hostess would come around with a glass of champagne and they'd have a couple of glasses of champagne, a Korean Ambien or an Indian Ambien, and next thing you know, they're whacked out, and you know it's a mess. You know, so but we had all kinds of funny things happen, but overall, just dealing with people was probably the biggest thing. And
out of flying international, what was your favorite destination to go to?
That's hard. I liked a lot of them. I did Paris, Tel Aviv, Johannesburg were probably my top three choices.
What'd you do in Africa? Like, what'd you do out there when you went out? Like, did you do anything on your overnights? Like, what was it?
Because we had to be there on an ultra long haul when you're more than 14 hours, more than 12 hours. You had to have 48 hours. Delta required 48 hours on the ground.
That's a good overnight.
It's a great overnight. So we'd arrive around 5 in the afternoon, clear customs, go to the hotel, go out for dinner. Next day, you know, do a workout, go sightseeing, whatever you want, dinner again. And it was just fun. It was like an eating and drinking club. But, you know, and then everybody shows up the next day. You've had almost a full day of rest again. And then off you go. And, you know, so it works out pretty good. Then on the really the long flights, the longer the flight, the longer the break. So you have four pilots. You have two captains, two first officers. And once you get to level off, the relief crew goes back to the crew rest. And on the 777, we had a beautiful crew rest facility. So you'd go up and you'd change into your T-shirt and sweatpants and hang up your uniform and go rack out for 2 hours, 2.5 hours, get some sleep, and then come back up and go back up on deck, and then it'd be time to eat. And then then you know, the other crew goes back, and the flight attendants would bring you a first-class meal.
How often was your rotation? So it was it every 4 hours or like?
It depended on the length of, the overall flight. But anything greater than 12 hours was usually 2.5 to 3 hours at least minimum, and sometimes it was 3.5, 3:45.
And you would come up 2 or 3 times during that flight to do that.
It just rotated twice.
Twice. Okay.
So, you know, the first crew would go back 3:45 later. They'd come back up, swap out, do it again, and you know.
How did you guys pick the landing? Rock, paper, scissors?
No, it was sometimes it was by need because some guys, we were trying to stay landing current, although it was virtually impossible because if you look at four pilots in a cockpit and you only fly twice a month, so I'm getting 4 legs a month and 4 guys in there, so chance of me staying current 90 days, you know, 3 landings, 3 takeoffs isn't going
to
happen.
Did you have to go to the sim all the time to do that?
I loved going to the sim.
Really?
And the reason was that we got paid
very well,
amply for going to the sim. I could jump on a 6 o'clock flight here, fly to Atlanta, go to the sim for 2 hours, get more proficient. And actually, the more time you spend in the sim, the better you get at flying the sim. And that sounds kind of hokey a little bit, but there's a knack to that, because you get to, again, you get to see more. That gives you more visual cues that might happen on the airplane. So the more time you spend doing engine cuts, and we'd practice all kinds of stuff there. We get our three landings and three takeoffs,
you still had time.
Got all the Cat 3 stuff done. But then we do engine cuts and all the stuff. Well, when it came time to go to recurrent, which,
you're sharp.
You can just sit down and do recurrent. And you've practiced all your memory items and you've done all the stuff. So it made recurrent a super easy breeze. And also I felt maybe more proficient in the airplane. So when you're not flying very much, the simulator time became very valuable.
So you have over 14,000 hours?
Yes.
And how many over 50 years of flying? Are we getting there yet?
Yeah, so we're there. I got 51 years.
So we have an award coming?
We do. So
can you talk a little bit about
July 3rd of 1972 is when I soloed. Or not July 3rd. That's when I had my first flight in my logbook. And then sold on my birthday. So the FAA has this award called the Master Pilot Award. And if you've been actively flying for more than 50 years, they have an award for that. So I just got notified actually yesterday that they're going to do a presentation probably in November for it. Wow. So, it's kind of neat. It's like I'm not real big on awards and stuff, But this one kind of touched me because...
Yeah, it's 50 years.
If you've done something for 50 years, you're still here. And, so you must be doing okay with it.
That's amazing. Congratulations on that. That's one I look forward to. I'm like, okay, I got probably about 10 in or something like that.
It's like
40 more to go.
Yeah, And I'll tell you what else I like is that I'm enjoying it more now, or as much now as I ever have in my life. So I feel blessed to be in good enough health where I can still fly. But, I'm flying with people that we all know.
Yeah.
And I'm flying the Citation 650. I'm flying the Mustang by myself. And
before we go to that flying, because I'd like to talk about that flying. How was that last flight at Delta, setting that parking brake and just picking up your bags?
It sucked because it was during COVID.
Okay.
And so there was no last flight.
Wow.
I took the early buyout because they'd grounded all the 777s. Basically there's no destinations to go to. So I took the early buyout and it was anticlimactic. Although I did really like the buyout.
So do you remember your last flight?
What I did was a friend of mine was flying one of the Frankfurt cargo runs in the 777. This is all during COVID. And so I called Manny and I said, "Look, Manny, I'd really like to go for one more flight. Can you put me on your jump seat to go to Frankfurt? Then I'll buy dinner." So he goes, "Absolutely." So I went up, jumped on the flight. We flew out of Chicago, Frankfurt, and got to sit in the seat, look around, watch the sunrise over the Atlantic one more time, which is really kind of breathtaking. There's a couple things you see when you're flying international a lot. One of them is the Northern Lights, because you're up in the tracks going across the Atlantic, and you see the Northern Lights a lot, which is pretty spectacular. And then you see the sunrise. There's just something great about a sunrise in the morning.
It is.
So I dearly love that. And I got to see the sunrise one more time like that, and then had a great, great time with Manny and the rest of the crew in Frankfurt, and then turned around and came back and came home, and I think my wife sold my uniforms in a garage sale.
Some kid's going to be wearing that thing for Halloween.
Yeah. So... but it was good. It was fine.
So retired from the airlines now, no longer in the Air Force, so you still keep yourself flying, which is awesome.
Yeah,
I plan on doing the same thing when I, ever retire. I just can never walk away.
Well, you gotta keep doing stuff. I think if you feel like it and you feel like you want to, I think you need to. So I was at a point where I was kind of going to walk away. And a good friend of mine, Robert Moses, has got a Citation 560. And so... he said, "Look, come and help me with my company. Come and do this. Work for me here, and I'll get you checked out, and you can be the chief pilot or whatever in the 560. So whatever that was, whatever that meant to me at the time, I go, "Oh, okay." And he did. He got me checked out in the airplane. He helped me get started in it.
Jumping from the 777 to the Citation.
Yeah. The seat doesn't – it's not an electric seat. It's hard to get into. It's really hot. The air conditioner doesn't work well. But other than that, it's kind of a cool flying airplane.
It's like a little sports car.
So I took my type ride with 2 hours and 10 minutes of instruction before my type ride. And it gives back to this thing where I hope none of the lights come on, because I really quite don't understand what's going on here yet. But, you know, I had to go through all the things like all your student pilots do. I had to get ForeFlight. I had to get flightplan.com. I had to get an iPad set up, learn how to use this stuff. So I went through all the growing pains, you know.
Did you guys use what was your backup app at Delta?
We had the Delta app, and that was it.
So you didn't even use Flight Deck Pro, like?
No. We had the Delta app, the widget app, and it was phenomenal. I mean, Delta did a great job. You know, top of the line company, just like Spirit. But you know, Delta did a great job designing the app. So that's all we had. You know, at first we didn't even have iPads that were connected.
To Wi-Fi.
Yeah, we had just Wi-Fi only iPads, which kind of sucked because you had to load everything in the airport before you got on the airplane.
Right.
But, you know, things progressed rapidly. You got into data link. The flight plans would push with data link. You know, your iPads hooked up. It's like, it was pretty sweet. So
you miss CPDLC?
Oh, yeah. No, you get a whole route loaded up to everything. And then at first, when I first started flying the 777, we had to load everything by hand into the FMSs. And so an India, a Mumbai flight plan would take you, JFK Mumbai, it would take you 35 minutes of typing to load the flight plan.
Wow.
And then you had to check it.
And the probability of errors are very high when you're putting that many fixes, that many airways.
So one guy would type and one guy would verify. One guy would type and one guy would verify. And it took us 35 minutes sitting there to load a decent flight plan. And then you had to load the winds manually too. Oof. So it was the points, the winds, everything. And so, you know, it was a process. But then later on, you could just push load. And there it is.
Verify that everything checks.
Yeah, so progress is amazing and technology is amazing.
Do you have something like that on the citation? Or are you still...
On some of the citations, you know, you can... they got Flight Connect. And Flight Connect works great. You can upload flight plans from your iPad or marry your flight, your iPad to the active flight.
We just got the Flightstream 510 for my friend's citation because I'm like, loading a flight plan. We don't have an APU, right? So, like, we're burning gas trying to put this. The savings of the flight stream is just
So you can keep your iPad synced, and it's just beautiful. But like the Mustang I'm flying, it's got an older G1000, so it's not eligible for flight stream connectivity. But you know, it's like the technology's cool. It's like it makes our lives a lot easier and a lot safer. You know,
how is it from, you know, you mentioned you had great dispatchers at Delta to now flying, you're everything, right?
I'm my favorite dispatcher.
You're a dispatcher, catering.
Well, you know what's funny is that I don't mind doing that stuff because I don't have a lot of other stuff that bothers me, that I'm bothered with to do. So, you know, I've got the time to make the phone calls, to call the FBOs, to shop gas on CAA, to do all the different things we're going to do.
By the way, whoever's not, I don't know if it was you, or I think you mentioned CAA, but the previous owner also mentioned CAA. If you have a private airplane,
CAA is a good deal.
You need to have CAA. I think we, on the first place we went to, we saved the entire membership and more.
Oh, yeah.
Just on gas.
No, I mean, we're talking $2 or $3 a gallon.
Oof. And fees, even on the fees, like parking and all that stuff. You know, we just went to Teterboro the other day. I didn't know we had to have a
reservation.
Yeah, didn't know we had to have a reservation.
You should call.
I landed like, do you have a reservation? I'm like, yes, for dinner. I get 15 minutes. We got to go.
No, I'm here.
And the guy goes, no, here at this time of the year, you need a reservation here.
So you got the UN, you got the US Open, you got the UN in session.
There was a fashion show and everything. And I'm
Fashion Week.
I'm like, yeah, it's not going to happen.
You should probably call. Yeah.
But they let me in. And we're sneaking in the little citation through all these jets. Hello.
Yeah, for those that haven't been to Teterboro is the epicenter for corporate jet aviation. It is so impressive.
You know, I'd never flown in there, obviously, right? Never did any of the little jet flying. Yeah. So coming in there and I was just looking with my peripheral because we're coming in at night, so I'm not familiar with the airport, making sure that I'm not, you know, missing anything. But with my peripheral vision, I just see stacks of jets, just, you know, head to tail.
And big jets.
And we're not talking about citations, we're talking about big boys.
Yeah.
I'm like, if I were to try to make a reservation, they'd be like, no, we don't have space for this little guy. We need to make space for the global. So I'm kind of glad that I didn't make a reservation because I would just sneak the right in.
No, it's like, it's a really cool, but you know, like I came out of there the other night in the Mustang by myself and, we take off, it's like 8 o'clock at night and you take off out of Teterboro and they turn to south along the river. And you get the Hudson River and the whole skyline on your left. And you're here at like 3,000 feet or 4,000 feet. And it's the most beautiful view. So, you know, I think as we fly and stuff, you know, you still have these views that capture you.
No matter how many times you do it. You know, a great example is the shoreline here, like the South Beach shoreline.
Yeah.
I mean, I told banners there, I gave tours there. I grew up in that shoreline. Every time that I fly that shoreline, I'm like, this is beautiful.
It's beautiful.
Like, you always find something that you never seen before. And
so,
it's like,
so, you know, I think for pilots that watch this, I think that we all share that same feeling, is that at moments we capture these moments sometimes in our brain. And it's a cruise along the Hudson to see the skyline of New York. It's a sunrise over the Atlantic. It's whatever it is, you know, and it's beautiful. It's like,
it's funny because we were coming, you know, we left Teterboro probably about the same time the sunset was, you know, coming down. And I'm looking at my four flight and beautiful sunset. Like, I mean, and taking photos of the shore of the whole island and everything, all the lights lit up. And I'm looking at my four flight and I see a TFR over Space Kennedy Center. And I click on there and I'm like, oh no, we're going to pass it. We're going to be an hour early. I'm like, if I would have known an hour early, what a better way to end this flight than to be flying right over the Space Center when they're launching a freaking rocket into the air.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, if I had the gas right now, I'd be pulling back.
Pull it back, slow it down.
Slow this thing back because we want to see this. Yeah. I mean, can you imagine? I don't know. Have you seen it yet? Have you seen it from the
air? No, I've never really seen a good space launch.
I had one. I was leaving New York, and we were all kind of wondering, like, what in the world is this? We're looking at, because it, you know, you see TV and movies, right? You see it go up straight up into the sky, but it doesn't really do that. It kind of comes up in an angle. And we're coming down from New York, and I see this thing, like, looks like a freaking missile, like, was launched, right? Because it's very, very, like, parallel to the Earth.
Yeah.
On the departure angle, I guess. At least that's what it looked like from our peripheral.
Yeah.
And I'm like, curiosity killed the cat, right? I'm like, Center, this is Spirit Boat. What's that target at 11 o'clock? It looks, like, fast and high. He goes, I got nothing up in my scope. I'm like, it looks like maybe a space vehicle launch. No, we have no notification of that. And we're all like, and then you hear the other pilots, everybody's looking out the window wondering the same thing. They're like, what is this? And they're like, we don't see it either on our scope. It's not painting anything else. And everybody's wondering it. And the guy goes like, stand by. He's calling. Yeah. What in the world is this in our airspace? Because it looked like it was
so close
to us. Yeah. Like we it looked like it was something in our area, right? And this controller's like, nobody's warned me about this. Like, what is something flying through my... So I'm sure the phone calls went down all the way in the chain of command. Like, what do we have in the airspace that we don't know what's talking about?
Yeah, what are they talking about?
And then finally they came back and said, hey, no, it's a launch from South Florida. And I'm like, man, from South Florida now here. It was amazing.
Wow. So bright.
Yeah. That's any other cool things? Any weird stuff coming over the Atlantic?
No, you know, I've never been picked up by a UFO. And I get asked that more than you can believe. But no, it's just I've had a great life.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw this, but there was never picked up by a UFO.
Yeah. No.
there was an interview of a Navy guy, I think, recently, a Navy fighter pilot that they've been seeing stuff and picking up stuff. And even the Navy admitted, you know, it's like, listen, we have these targets and we don't know what these targets are. I think they upgraded the radar on their airplanes and they were out there like, what is all this stuff?
You know, if you really put it all in perspective, and you go back to the 50s, the Skunk Works designed the SR-71 in the 50s. Insane technology. You know, 60,000+ feet, Mach 3, built out of titanium. I mean, the technology they had back then was just stunning. The 60s, you know, we saw more evolutions of things like that. You know, in Desert Storm, we saw the unveiling of the F-117 that had been kept under wraps for all these years. So, you know, I really feel in my heart there's all these black programs that both manufacturers and the government have that they're not trying to share with people. You know, they really don't want to bring it out because we don't want to give it to China or Russia or whoever. And, you know, I think there's technology out there that you know, is pretty cool.
I agree with you. I think everybody's all excited about, you know, aliens. But to me, I think it's more either hopefully it's ours and not another country's that they develop this stuff and we don't even know about it. And we think that they're UFOs. But if you, again, the same thing that you're talking about, when you look at the trajectory of our technology advancements, it kind of, it almost looks like we stopped really growing. And it's like, did we stop growing, or is it something that we just don't know?
Or are we hiding it better?
Or we're hiding it better.
And you know, if you really, if you just took a line, if you just took a technology line and said, okay, let's start in 1962 with the SR-71, let's just draw a straight line out here. Look where you'd be right now.
Right.
50 years later, 60 years later, you know, you're in a position where the technology is astronomical. So, you know, I really feel in my heart that, you know, and we've done stuff like we've flown air combat missions at night where we drop flares, decoy flares. Well, that's a pretty impressive thing to do too, but it lights up the sky in a bunch of different weird ways. So, you know, I think there's also things that happen normally that people see that they don't quite understand or may not assimilate. But I just think the United States has always been a leader in technology. You know, from the early space program all the way through. And I'm sure other countries do a great job too. But I think we built stuff that's pretty cool.
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, that's my answer. Since I haven't been picked up by UFO, I can't verify that. But I think we do really well with technology. I think it's out there.
Dennis, what's the future look like for you? Are you going to continue flying?
Yeah, I'm having fun now.
Looking to buy an airplane at some point?
You know, I had a Warrior not too long ago with a glass cockpit and stuff. Beautiful Garmin cockpit, beautiful Warrior. And I probably should have kept that. I really liked that airplane. But, you know, it was convenient. It was easy. And, you know, it burned 5 or 6 gallons of fuel an hour. And it was just fun. We'd go down to Key West a lot. My wife's from Key West. But, you know, no, I'm really not too interested in owning. I enjoy flying. I enjoy the people I work with. So I do more of picking and choosing the owners of aircraft and the aircraft I want to fly. So, you know, there's kind of a, it's nice to be in that position. And I like the team again, you know. A lot of the owners I fly with are just wonderful, wonderful people, wonderful families.
It gives you a mission.
Yeah. And so, you know, I feel like I'm taking care of them when we fly. And I enjoy the whole thing. So.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's fun.
Well, thank you so much for coming, Dennis. It's been a great interview. I'm so glad to have you, to share your story, and I'm excited for your Master Pilot Award. Wright Brothers Award
yeah.
from the FAA. Congratulations yeah. again on receiving that award.
I think you're
very inspirational to any pilot, especially they want to go down the military route or Delta route and international flying. Thank you so much for coming, Dennis.
Thank you, Felipe. I appreciate it.
And hopefully we get to fly sometime. I'm going to take you on the Citation sometime. So you show me a few tricks.
Yeah, we'll go now. Let's go play.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed the show. For more of our content, search on YouTube for Aviator Zone. If you know someone we should have on the show, please reach out at podcast@aviator.zone.